Notice how some homes sell faster in your neighborhood? It's not luck. It's local know-how. RE/MAX agents know their streets, schools, and communities inside and out. And with RE/MAX, those local pros are everywhere. Which means when you're ready to buy or sell, you'll get trusted neighborhood insight that puts you a step ahead. Reach out today. RE/MAX, the experts close to home. Each office independently owned and operated.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. I'm a bit terrified of dementia. I'm scared that one day I'm going to look in the mirror and not know myself. I'm scared that the person I was and the life I lived will slip through both my fingers and the ridges of my brain, and I will simply be an old person who used to be this person talking to you now. These fears aren't entirely unfounded. Both of my grandmothers passed away after dealing with dementia or Alzheimer's, and watching them lose their sense of self as my parents, uncles, and aunts all tried to hold on to their parent was heartbreaking. Memory is a powerful thing. The memories we hold and the memories others hold of us. Losing those, in a way, breaks that tenuous tie we have to one another, our shared history. We've come up with loads of reasons to explain memory loss in recent years. A lot of people blame social media, for example, for destroying our memories without ever asking the bigger questions, like, what is memory? How does it work? Why is it so fallible? Dr. Althea Need Kaminsky is a cognitive psychologist who teaches at the Indiana University School of Medicine. She's interested in the application of human memory research in educational settings. She also helps run the Learning Scientists, an international group of cognitive psychologists who engage in science communication about the science of learning. Her new book, The Psychology of Memory, came out earlier this month, and she is my guest today. Here's Dr. Althea Need Kaminsky. Welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I am so pumped to get to talk to you because you don't know this, but I have been searching for you for years. I have been wanting to talk to an expert specifically in your field for quite a long time. So for people who don't know you or your work, tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
I am Dr. Althea Need Kaminsky. I am currently the Senior Director of Student Academic Success at Indiana University School of Medicine, where my job is to help medical students learn better. I am a cognitive psychologist by training. So my area of training and research is in human learning and memory. When I'm not working with medical students, I am part of a group, the Learning Scientists, a group of cognitive psychologists who work to make the research on learning and memory accessible to anybody who wants to know more about how learning and memory work. We have a blog, a podcast, and some free resources, mostly geared towards teachers, students, and again, just anyone who's interested in learning more about their learning.
I love that. First of all, compliments on the sound quality. I love getting to talk to another podcaster. So I'm actually really interested in this because, you know, you have a new book coming out. You were very humble. You didn't plug that right up top, but you do have a new book coming out in a few days called The Psychology of Memory. Now, exactly what memory is and how it functions seems to be both like widely misunderstood, taken for granted, but also just like applicable to everything all of the time. I remember scratching the surface of understanding that memory wasn't what I thought it was back in undergrad when we. So I grew up, my undergrads in social science, criminal justice specifically. So we were, of course, learning about like witness testimony and the fallibility of memory at that time. And of course, that meant studying the invisible gorilla experiment regarding like selective attention. So first things first, what is memory?
Memory is, I mean, I agree with the assessment that memory touches more things than people typically think of when they first sit down to think about memory. And there are a lot of different ways we can talk about memory. The definition that I find most useful and that we use in the book is that memory is the use of past information in service of the present or future. So it is our ability to use information, things we have encountered in the past, in the context of the present. And that also can be extended to the future. It turns out there's a whole interesting area of research showing that it's difficult for us to imagine things that we have not had experience with. And so memory is important for that as well. But I think another important aspect of memory is that it's something that helps us make meaning in our lives because it helps provide context for an understanding for things that are happening to us.
So, you know, what's interesting that you talk about imagination, because I've talked to other experts whose fields overlap with this specific research, specifically in fields like trauma, behavioral science. You know, I got to talk to a fascinating researcher last fall who talked about how anger has an evolutionary purpose, how all of the emotions have an evolutionary purpose, and how anger helps us like get things done and actually improves cognition in a lot of ways. And a lot of experts have told me that memory is less like the file retrieval system that we all seem to think it is. Like, you know, oh, my sixth birthday is just somewhere stuck back in there. And the more I live, the more I'm going to have to shove back in there. And it's less like that and more like an active imagination. Is that accurate? And if so, that's scary.
Yes. Yes. So yeah, memory is a dynamic, living, changing thing within you as a dynamic, living, changing human. It is not static. It is not, like you said, like a file cabinet, or I think a more common or accessible metaphor for people is like a Google search, right? Like I typed in car keys and nothing's coming up, right? Like how do I find things, right? And really often people think of memory in that way, that it is a static thing. I can't find the thing I'm looking for. And so that I think that consequently means that we have a lot of examples of times when our memory failed us. And which is unfortunate because I think we have fantastic memories and our memories do so much for us. So instead of just being this like thing that you can just like pull out of your head, instead we are using past information in service of the present, which means we can change our memories. Our memories are always changing, which is scary. As you mentioned, people don't like that. People want there to be one objective truth or reality. And when I used to teach memory as a class, I would tell the class that if I have not made you had an existential crisis by the end of this, I don't think I've really like done my job. I really need you to like panic deeply about the fact that nothing you know is an objective reality or truth, but in fact, multiple truths exist at the same time. And we can talk about it with science. So when our memory changes, I think that means a lot of really positive, good things for us. It means you can change your mind. It means that you can reevaluate what you used to know in the context of maybe some new information, right? It means that you can maybe have a better understanding of why you perceived something the way you did, right? It's like going back to maybe your elementary school playground and being like, oh no, this is smaller than it was in my memory or in my head, right? And it's not because the playground has grown, it's because you have, right? And so there can be differences in our memory that are actually like a really positive thing and signs of growth. It also means that once we know that that's how our memory works, that it works sort of in combination with cues in our environment, we can improve it. We can practice it. If there's something, you know, very important that we do definitely want to remember that fact or figure, right? If you are, for example, studying for medical school, there are some things you have to know and you have to know them really quickly. But understanding how it works, right, can help us design learning scenarios and design strategies to improve memory in like really specific ways.
So, you know, you've talked a little bit about how, you know, memory is fallible. Obviously, it's not exactly, you know, it's informing, you know, past events of informing today. So how accurate exactly are our memories? And is there something that might make a a given memory more or less likely to be accurate? Like, are there signs that when I'm remembering something, I can be like, oh, you know what? This doesn't feel like a thing that might have actually happened. It might be a thing that I might be making up in my head.
So there is a concept in the literature of something called false memories, mm-hmm. wherein... Mm-hmm.
Satanic panic in the 80s. We're yeah. very well yeah. versed in those here.
right. That we just have, because our memory is a thing, the other way that I talk about memory a lot is that it is a reconstructive process instead of reproductive, mm-hmm. right? It's not like we're just reproducing the thing that was already stored away in the file. We are, every time we're remembering something, we're actively rebuilding that memory. And your brain is going like, hey, based on what I kind of already think I know, and there's some things going on, you know, some clues I've got in my environment, here's kind of my reconstruction of what happened. And so we can give people false memories. But usually this is something where it's like we read a word list and all of these words seem to be really similar and have something in common, but we don't say that one thing. And then we ask people later to recall, list out all the words, and they list that one thing that was never presented. Now we'll do tests on it to see like, okay, was that something, the distinction we'll do is like, did you remember that? Like, you remember me saying that word, or do you just kind of like know it was there, right? So to get at your question of like, how is there like a sign? Is there a difference for these words that people are falsely remembering? Do they remember it, or do they just kind of know, and maybe that's a sign that it was something that didn't happen? And unfortunately, the answer is there's no difference. Those memories behave and look and feel exactly like the ones that we know objectively did happen. So there's that, is that you don't really know. This, I think, lends some more credibility to the idea of like that was real for you, right? Like if this is something that you have recreated in your mind, like it's still a real memory for you, whether or not that memory has been strongly influenced or is not real for others is kind
like,
of a
I just want to ask a clarifying question for myself. It sounds like you're saying it's still a real memory for you in the sense of, if we're defining memory as past events that are affecting the way that we currently interact with the world, then it being real for me is real in the sense that whatever it is that I think that I remember is currently being used to inform how I reply to somebody, how I might behave, how I might vote, how I might, take this job over that job or something like that. So it's real in the sense of it is having a real impact, even though it might not be objectively true. I just want to make sure I'm understanding.
Yes, exactly. Right. Because it is something you are experiencing is impacting how you were thinking, potentially how you're behaving in the world. Obviously, this has a lot of unsettling implications, especially you mentioned satanic panic. Another thing that happened in the 80s was, unfortunately, a wave of media around repressed memories and this idea that something bad happened and I didn't know. And so there's a lot of, public attention on like, well, how do you know what's real and what's not? And so what's interesting from that is like, one, if someone has experienced a repressed memory, again, that is still something real for them. And they may in fact have some, trauma and some things to unpack from having now experienced this thing. Did it objectively happen in the sense that a very real sense that is important for, like, are there people doing harm out there that we need to be aware of? And the answer is, it's very likely that repressed memories are something that it can be kind of induced, implanted in someone, right? And understanding how that happens can be really informative for how we respond, especially in the case of children who have highly malleable memories, right? What are best practices when we're asking, from a place of concern, right? How do we carefully handle and treat memories when they're vulnerable, when the people are vulnerable, but also the memories, right? And you mentioned before about like, implications for like criminal justice and the legal system, right? And that's where a lot of this work has been, onto like, hey, we need to know, we need to assess, did this happen? Was a crime committed? How can we get high fidelity memories when memories change, right? Is a really important question.
That continues to be where my brain goes, because it's like, there's multiple pieces here, because if something is a memory for you, if even if it's objectively not something that happened, but if it's a a recreated memory based on what other people told you, and child's memory is fallible and all of those things. And you're being told that, oh no, you were actually going to be sacrificed to Beelzebub down in a basement somewhere. And that none of those things ever happened. But there is a truth in that it is true for you now in the sense that it is causing you harm. And that is, the harm is real. We really need to help you. However, I also need to understand whether this was a real thing that happened and whether there's other kids in basements or whether this is just something that you believe happened and we just need to make sure that you have the mental health care that you need, or do we need to be doing both things? Like that's the important distinction that I think people forget. Like they write stuff off sometimes. We saw similar things like with QAnon and, Pizzagate and stuff like that. Is that like, okay, there's people that really believe these things are happening. And they're convincing themselves of it through this like personal game of telephone, the internet, conspiracy theory, that kind of thing. And that needs to be dealt with. But also we need to know, is there really something going on? Or is this just a thing that we made up for attention on the internet? And we need to understand the reality of both of those things. And I think the problem that a lot of people have is they say, oh, well, if it didn't objectively happen, we can throw the whole thing out. We right. don't have to deal with any of the harm. And right. that's where I think a lot of people run into a problem.
Yes. And another thing, right? So it gets scary, right? Like you said, it gets scary when there's not an objective reality, right? And I think so an important distinction here is between misremembering or having a false memory and lying, right? Mm-hmm. Lying is when you know you know something didn't happen or you don't remember, whatever, and you are willfully and intentionally portraying a falsehood, right? Like mm-hmm. there is an intentionality there. There is deceit, right? That is intentional. But there are many people, right? There are in many circumstances where it's not a lie. They aren't trying to, pull one over on somebody. They really do honestly believe that, right? And like you said, we can't dismiss the harm that's being done to them or to others just because, through other means, we can, verify that, like, okay, that's not actually happening. Right, I think a more nuanced understanding of how we can get from point A, which is maybe misinformation, sources of misinformation mm-hmm. or mishandling of vulnerable people at, inopportune times, right? How does that translate to a change in memory? The other thing that is, I think, an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about which memories are real and which are false is understanding which narratives we lend more weight to in these circumstances and which ones we don't, because we're never going to have one objective truth or reality, right? Because everyone will have different experiences of that to some extent. That doesn't mean we can't have an agreed upon truth or reality that we as multiple people in some sort of social contract will say like, this seems, benign or whatever, or doesn't meet a legal definition of something, right? We can certainly have a widespread agreement, but it's not going to ever be 100%, right? Mm-hmm. So in the case where there is reasonable dispute about what happened based on people's memories, I think it's always interesting to note which memories do we lend more weight to versus others.
Well, that there you go. There's your sociology right there. That's your in-group, out-group. That's your preconceived biases. That's, I assume that people that look like me or have similar experiences like me are telling the truth. And anybody that doesn't look like me is probably just a big old fat liar. And mm-hmm. and they're less likely to be trustworthy. Is there a way to overcome that? I mean, sociology would tell you yes, but is there, from your perspective and your specific vein of research, is there something that we could do to improve that?
I think recognizing that, right? Like, but you can't correct a bias unless you know that that exists, right? So having more acknowledgement of that as like a potential bias and being able to ask yourself like, hey, this person's story really resonated with me, or like, I really believe them. Why is that? Like, maybe I need to question mm-hmm. that a little bit more and examine it. And maybe it's for very good reasons that you're perfectly fine with. And maybe it's maybe because you're like, well, am I unnecessarily discounting something because somebody doesn't look like me or doesn't share the same background as me? Why might somebody believe this? Right. And mm-hmm. to be able to hold both of those things in the same space to say like, I still maybe I still prefer or, am still on the side of or strongly believe this one account, but why might it be different? Why might somebody have a different account of this? does that still have some degree of weight or validity? And that answer may change, you know, there's not one right answer there, but I think you can't begin to address the problem unless you know the problem exists or the nature of it. And obviously we're talking about this in terms of like big picture, like scary, like legal implications and societal implications. This also, I also encourage people to view this, to take some pressure off of yourself to have to be right and 100% accurate all the time. Like that's not possible. And it is entirely possible that you misremembered something, right? Like I fall into this trap all the time of like, did I answer that email or did I just like write it out in my head and think that I responded, but I actually didn't. And so I try to be a little bit more patient and kind with myself to be like, it is, I really felt strongly that I did this thing or said this thing. However, there is a possibility that I didn't and I am misremembering it. So, right. And again, regardless of whether or not I did
now,
or
listen,
didn't.
There's also a middle ground because these email apps hate us. They hate us. And there's a middle ground where I thought I did it, but there's no proof that I did it. And there's no proof that I did it because the email hates me. It hates me. And the mail app is evil and does not want me to see heaven. So I've run into the past where I'm like, no, I swear to God, I sent this. It just decided to go into the ether somewhere. But here's the sent receipt. There it is.
True. Yay. True. Your email program may be gaslighting you is always an option.
Microsoft and Apple both. They all hate me. It's great. I love it so much. I want to turn to something that, you know, maybe it's a wives' tale, but smell. Smell
no
is
idea.
Thought to be the most accurate way to like retrieve memories. Is that true?
No.
And no?
No. I have like asked this question and been like, hey, like where's the research on smell? Because I've heard this. Everyone's heard this, right?
Yeah, everybody's heard that. There like, is, oh, you smell grandma's like, apple pie and suddenly you remember all these other stuff.
There's not been any test, like as far as I am aware of, like empirical scientific test of this concept. Two, if I think through, like as a researcher, like how would I test that? I don't even know like how we would do that. However, I think what does happen is smell can be much more. So when we think about what makes you more likely for you to be able to remember something versus something else, I've talked a little bit already about how like it's the environment, it's things happening in the present moment, interacting with the past. The word that we use to describe those things happening in the present moment are cues. What cues are going on for your brain to go, oh, that's like something, right? And, you know, recall a memory. And it's, a cue is useful to the degree that it is diagnostic or specific to a certain memory, right? So, for example, if I say, do you have that mug? You'd be like, which mug? I have several, right? I've encountered many mugs in my life. Which one, right? That is a non-specific cue and not super useful, right? And so the more specific I can be, the more likely it is that we're going to get at the specific memory. Now, smells are rich and complex sources of information, and you maybe don't encounter those smells to the same degree or frequency that you encounter other things. So I can see it being highly possible that you're like, oh my gosh, this smell has transported me in time because I don't smell apple pies that often. And now I have, and it's such a specific smell. And so it is evoking a specific memory. And so that's less about the smell itself and more just about like, I very rarely encountered this thing. And so when I do, it's really important for me. It's also often people talk about this in terms of memories that have a really high, like I remember this well, and this is an important thing and high, like emotive value. But there's also the possibility that like, you're not remembering the times you smelled a smell and couldn't place it, right? Like that's not standing out to you. So there are a few reasons why it might be something that is like, useful for memory. And then also a few reasons why like it might not be. And I just don't know. I don't have any strong evidence one way or the other.
So you also discuss in depth how aging and emotional state affect memory. Could you, listen, I know we're not going to write a thesis here, but could you give us the layman's version of how aging and emotion affect the way that we remember things?
You're probably fine. Everybody forgets things from time to time. Just to you, to anyone listening, because this is like a common thing that people are like, oh, I'm having a senior moment and I'm, you know, I can't remember. Because again, I think we're always more aware of things, examples of memory failures rather than successes. And so that's something that we're aware of that. And people know that there is generally a cognitive decline with aging. So we're like hyper aware of things. So there is like a normal amount of decline. It is very slow rate, very steady, but very, very slow. It's not like you hit a certain age and you're just like your memory goes off a cliff. Although obviously if there are like when, so then the follow-up question is like, when is this a concern? When is this something that like, maybe it's a sign of something else? And the answer is like when it interrupts your daily functioning. Like if this is, if your memory errors, if you like really, it's like, I struggle to make it to work on time. I struggle to do my job or make a living. Like if it really is like, I can't remember things when I'm at the grocery store and I never have food. Like if it really is getting in the way of your daily functioning, that's when it's time to see a clinician and to say like, hey, is something else going on here? Because there are, you know, all kinds of things that can happen, you know, to our brains and our bodies as we age. So there's that. There is also so that's on the back end, which I know is what usually when I tell people I study memory, they're like, oh God, you wouldn't want to study me. I'm terrible. I'm getting older. And I'm like, no, you're probably fine, right? Like there's a normal amount. And again, like it's normal to forget things. In fact, it's really useful and good to forget things. So you're probably fine.
I would not want to remember everything I saw, every face on every person that I walked past on the street, every smell I smelled, every bad date I had. Like, ugh.
There is one of my favorite short stories is Funes the Memorious by Borges, a Latin American writer, where he describes like somebody who, like, what would it be like if you remembered every single thing? And so this fictional person Funes who, I don't know, like hits his head and can remember everything. But like, that's what it, like he describes, like how overwhelming would that be? Like you wouldn't be able, we talked about a mug, right? And like, where's that mug? But what's the difference between my mug today with, I always have a collection of mugs on my desk because I'm really bad at cleaning.
Oh, I love the mug in the background with the tears of somebody's tears. It's great.
My sister made that for me and it says tears of my students. It's delightful. Thank you, Callie, for making
That's
me
fabulous.
But like, how do I know the difference between, right? Like this mug at this time in, you know, 2024 versus when I got this mug in like 2014, right? Those are two different mugs. They're different. Like that would be overwhelming. The other thing is like, there are like disorders where people can't forget. That's a big component of like post-traumatic stress disorder is like, you don't want to, sometimes really horrible things happen and you don't want to remember those people who would love to forget these things, right? And so that's, you know, kind of a trade-off that people don't realize is happening, that actually it's pretty good that we're forgetting things. Like you don't need to spend that time and space on stuff, right? Like there, you could be doing other things other than being like, which mug is this mug, right? Like that's not productive or useful. So forgetting is important. You talked about memory and aging and I covered the back half.
So I think my next question might actually help us circle back there. Like in my own family, we have dealt with issues of cognitive decline, dementia. I've had grandparents lost to Alzheimer's, that terrible A word that nobody wants to think about anymore. And we all kind of hope there's a pill to fix in the next 20 years. I've heard everything from there's absolutely no way to prevent any of this, to you can stave off losing your memories and your sense of self through crosswords every day. Does your research give us any hope into how to maintain our cognition as we age?
There is a lot of really exciting advancements in Alzheimer's research, sort of better understanding it and other neurodegenerative disorders. My limited understanding is that there's some complex protein folding happening and things kind of cascade from there. But I mean, something like Alzheimer's.
Not fold those. Let's get better at protein folding, or let's.
There's something that happens with proteins
and fold. Okay. And let's get Martha Stewart in there. She's real good at folding things.
Something happens and it gums up the works. And I mean, with Alzheimer's, it is a progressive disease in which like memory loss is one of the most salient symptoms, but mm-hmm. it affects all systems in the brain eventually. And so there's research mixed on this, right? We know that there is a genetic component, right? But we also know that it shows up earlier and later in some people. There's some research to suggest that there are protective or beneficial effects of exercise and keeping sharp. That generally means having like rich social lives.
Oh, right? No, I'm screwed. I'm a writer. Do you have any idea how isolating that is?
I'm aware. So there is some evidence that at least in like general cognitive decline that like staying active and like having like social programming is really beneficial. But it's not a cure, right? That doesn't mean that prevents or removes Alzheimer's. It may be the evidence suggests that it might have a protective effect, right? So maybe it delays onset by a little bit. Just generally, I mean, your brain is in your body. So general things to help your overall health and wellness are beneficial. Don't live near a highway would be my other recommendation. Things like air pollution and having like heavy metals in the air from gas. And I think mostly it's actually rubber tires that are contributing to that your brain can't filter out, and that negatively contributes. I know it's terrifying. But we do see population-wide studies about like an incidence of cognitive decline being increased for people who live closer to areas of higher air pollution. I know.
Great.
I know, you're horrified. You're horrified. Yes.
It's good.
Yes, I know. That. I know. Right. And awesome. So some of it is like you can't control everything.
Rubber tires help cause memory decline?
They're the number one contributor to air pollution.
Especially in the U.S., where like everyone needs a car all of the time, everywhere. Like that's not great.
Don't live by a highway, and maybe invest in public transportation would be my personal view on that. Is that maybe we should be less car dependent? But that's infrastructure problem, as you point out. It's terrifying. For a few years was would supervise senior research projects in the behavioral neuroscience program, which just meant that like every year I'd have these really smart students come to me with the most terrifying research I've ever seen in my life. And that was one of them like 2 years ago, where I was like, oh, I had the same reaction you did, where I was like, oh, cool, fine. I'll just like not drive a car, I guess.
I'm just going to start riding my horse everywhere, I guess. Sorry, Rusty.
right. Not great. But right, which is to say there are a lot of environmental impacts, right? But none of these things are like cures or causes, right? With any of these disorders, there are always a multitude of factors that contribute to it. So there are some things you can maybe do to kind of help. Crossword puzzles, maybe kind of for general cognitive decline. Alzheimer's is a very specific type, right? And so I wouldn't feel as strong about that recommendation. Or at least, I mean, it's always difficult.
I think that one was invented by the New York Times to sell papers, to be honest. I think that one was just
there is some evidence that at least crossword puzzles where you are, right? It's requiring you to like use certain types of your memory, semantic memory and associative networks, and remember things in ways that you wouldn't. And so for that, it can protect that type of memory because you're using it more often. But like, is that going to be like, that's not the thing that's going to, the fact that you didn't do crossword puzzles is not the reason why someone's going to get Alzheimer's, right? And I feel like people usually talk about it like, oh, you should have done this or this or this. Any of these recommendations might maybe help, but it's, again, these are not cures. These are they have limited effectiveness. And these things are also really difficult to study at scale, right? Because in order to study, to run an experiment to figure out.
You would need a whole lifetime of data for a whole lot lifetime, of people.
And you would have to know who is going to get Alzheimer's when and assign them to do a task 10 years before they get this. And then, right. And so all of these things that we've talked about.
And like, then of course you have to decide, do I tell these people they're going to get it in 10 years? Do I keep that information from them? If I tell them, is that poisoning the well of the data? Like, right, that's a study I don't want to construct.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's complicated, but like, what can I, but like the, you know, what can I do as like a person to have a healthy memory and to be, you know, sort of cognitively active as I age and I'm maybe more concerned about these things. There are some very reasonable things that at the very least, right, whenever I am asked to make recommendations on this to people, I say like, okay, one, I am not a medical doctor. So like, please consult people who actually like study Alzheimer's and like clinicians, there are people, neuroscientists, neurologists who like actually do these things. But right, if I'm thinking about like reasonable recommendations to make based off of like cognitive science literature, like your brain is in your body. So you probably do need to go for a walk and touch grass every now and then. Like that is actually very good. Anything that helps your overall health and well-being in terms of like maintaining social contacts and right, like investing in your wellness, and that means different things to different people. Having things that make you feel a sense of connection with others, right? Which can be broadly defined and highly individual. Diets and nutrition, but again, the sort of basics in terms of like, are you eating protein and drinking water?
And not folding those proteins. Don't fold them.
Don't fold the proteins. Right? There are a lot of things you could do that are just like taking care of yourself, that takes care of your brain too, which I know is not what people want. People want me to tell them like, do Sudoku and you'll be fine. And that's not the answer. The answer is like all the stuff that you already know, but maybe.
I am really glad it's not Sudoku because I don't like that game. So speaking of other kind of like dispelling of myths or at least maybe clarifying them, short-term memory, long-term memory, all sorts of folks, you know, out there will be like, oh, well, you need to do such and such for something to go from a short-term memory to a long. What are each of these things? Are they actually that different when it comes to our brain and what they're doing inside of our brain? And how do we maybe improve that flow between the two?
So one of the reasons I decided to study memory, when I look back and say like, okay, like what made me like choose this? I took a class in college and we read a book called Memory's Ghost that was fascinating. It was written by, I think, Philip Hiltz, who's a writer, not a researcher. And he laid out memory in a really interesting way and what do different mythologies say about memory, going into like philosophy and then the science. And then he actually had the ability to interview one of the most famous patients in memory research, H.M., who we now know as Henry Molaison. H.M., when he was a young man, I think I want to say in his 20s, although I'm a little sketchy on the actual dates and ages, he had a lot of seizures, and this was a problem. And so they took him to various doctors, finally one agreed to operate on him and to do sort of a pioneering surgery to take out an area of his brain to mitigate the seizures. And it was a success. The doctor noted his seizures were greatly reduced. There was just one kind of small thing that happened afterwards. And that is that he appeared to not have a long-term memory anymore, or he appeared to not be able to form new memories.
He's a goldfinch.
So what happened was they surgically removed his hippocampus, which is a small structure in the middle of the brain that we now know, largely as a result of this, which is responsible for helping to consolidate, to store memories and move them, as you're talking about, from short-term to long-term memory. So what this meant for Henry was that he could have a conversation with you and kind of rely on context cues and stuff and say, hey, Don, how's it going? Really nice day we're having here. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then after, you know, maybe a minute or two, he'd be like, I'm so sorry. Have we met? Right? Because he could not remember. And so he went from being dealing with these, you know, extreme seizures, but otherwise being like normal, healthy guy to obviously having to go and like assisted living because he couldn't, if the layout changed in his grocery store, he couldn't navigate it because he had no idea where he was. So he had all of his old memories, but couldn't form new ones. And it was deeply fascinating and disturbing to me, right? And it really helped me understand, right, when we talked about like, what is memory? And I talked about memories, how we make meaning in our lives. It really horrifying to imagine what it must have been like for him who knew himself as a young man. And then, I mean, he lived to be, you know, a pretty old age. And occasionally the reports that he would occasionally have moments of like lucidity kind of where like people talk about like, oh, I maybe never aging or never, you know, being frozen in time. He was frozen in time and every once in a while would look in the mirror and see a different person staring back at him. An old man, everyone he's known and loved, gone. They did some really interesting studies with him, sleep studies that they describe in the book about like waking, like, What are dreams like, right? What are dreams like when you can't imagine the future, right? And they'd ask him to imagine the future and he always say, I don't know, right? Because we talked about it again, like he doesn't have context to know what's happening now or what has happened before. So how can you imagine what's going to happen? One of the descriptions that stuck out to me from that dream study was he said that he was like a boat. He thought he was like a boat trying to make it to shore, but he was just surrounded by fog, right? That he didn't know. Just constantly not knowing what came before or what was going to happen after, and literally only having the present moment and having being completely disoriented. So absolutely, we have a short-term and long-term memory. There is a very real difference between those things. And we know that the hippocampus is the structure of the brain that helps you go from what is the present moment to this is now something that I can access later. A lot of experiments have helped us kind of pinpoint what kind of the boundaries are on those. About 20 seconds is what it is experimentally for short-term memory. After 20 seconds, it is a long-term memory. Anything that you're pulling from, that is, I know. And it's a stupid distinction. I don't make the rules because clearly there's a difference.
It seems like a very short amount of time.
Yes. Short-term memory is very, very short. But I think when I think about it in terms of like when I'm designing experiments or looking at like actually remember things over a long term. And when we look at patients like HM, there have been a few other people who have had, Clive Waring is another subject. You can watch some YouTube videos about Clive, who had viral encephalitis and all that. He's British. And so all the videos have an interview of like British doctors who talk about viral encephalitis and they say it in the British way, which I find charming and amusing because it just sounds so funny to me, to my American ears. But he had that part, a similar part of his brain destroyed as this other patient. And so there's some really interesting interviews with him. And it does seem to be just like a few minutes for them, right? That you can kind of get by on context clues and kind of understanding like a conversation for maybe like 2 or 3 minutes. But when we like really put a hard line and test it, like ask you to remember like a series of digits or letters, and really interfere with that, it's like about 20 seconds. Now, clearly we feel like there's a pretty big difference between like short-term and long-term, but it's about 20 seconds. So what do we do move things out of long-term? You practice retrieving them. You practice recalling and you practice memory. You remember by remembering, which again is usually not what people want to hear, that you have the way
but
to
learn.
But
is that not playing a game of telephone with yourself? Like you talked about earlier, so much of our memory is imagination. Are we saying, okay, I want to remember, you know, what did I wear the first day of school in first grade? Is that, am I just making up overalls and a red shirt? Or is there a way to actually like, because we talked about earlier, there's no real way to test that the memory that we're recalling is true. So what do you mean when you say practice recall?
And as you point out, a really crucial feature of this is the quality of the feedback you get. when you recall something, right? So in terms of like somebody's name, right? Like this is a common question, right? Like, oh gosh, I'm terrible with names. How do I do that? Well, you use that person's name when you see them, right? In the book, I give an example of like, you go to work every day and you see pass someone in the hall and you say, hi. And right, super relatable human experiences, realizing that you've been saying hi to someone for like 3 years and you have no idea what this person's name is. Like, you know them, you recognize them, you chit chat with them. Like, you know that they're, you know, that they're kids in soccer and they've got a game coming up. If someone asks you what was her name, you'd be like, I've got no idea. I've got nothing. And so how do you prevent against that? And it's, well, you say, you know, hi, Melissa, when you see them in person, right? And you just practice using their name. Otherwise, it's, you don't, if you don't use it, you lose it. So like, how do you know, did you wear, you know, overalls in the first grade? You don't. You would maybe need to like find a way, if this is very important to you, right? Maybe find a way to verify that. But also this has some implications, I think for how we talk to ourselves and how we remember things about ourselves, right? That you can end up reinforcing things that are incorrect or maybe not healthy for you, right? Like it's maybe not useful to remember certain things and to ruminate on them and to overemphasize those things because you're making them have a stronger presence in your mind than you would otherwise, right?
So, you know, I was actually also curious to know a few things. One, unfortunately, because I'm an author and we all have to do our own marketing, I have to be on social media a lot. And I just want to know, is social media brain rot actually a thing? Like, is it actually destroying our brains like we all think it is? Or is it just, is it just there's so much information that like we can't possibly remember it all and we're confusing that for brain rot?
Yes, I think so. Like technology is
the answer. Just like yes, yeah, yes.
It's a tool like any other tool. And I think when you understand how it affects your memory and attention, you can decide how to engage with this in ways that are helpful and useful for you. And then also important, how to disengage with it in ways that are helpful and useful for you. One of the things I'll talk with students a lot about is it's a tool you need to learn how to use it so it doesn't use you, right? So social media, our phones, our screens, everything, right, that we're interacting with is designed, like your attention is the resource that these things are designed to capture, right? Like people have invested all kinds of money and research into how to capture your attention because hopefully your attention equals your money, right? In some way, shape, or form, right? And so they, in a very real way, they are designed to capture attention and to increase tendencies that make you switch your attention and go all around. You can know that and choose to not do that, right? Turn off notifications, limit, you know, structure things and limit it so that you are engaging with this social media when you want to engage with it and not when the algorithm has tried to grab your attention, right? And so it's, my stance generally on technology is it is a morality neutral thing, right? Just technology in general, and whether or not you use it for good or for ill, right, is up to you. But certainly understanding how it works, I think it can help you decide how it's going to affect you. Because I don't think it's like making us dumber or anything, but it is certainly encouraging certain types.
That's good.
It's encouraging certain behaviors and actions and maybe discouraging others. Because I'm always, when I'm working with medical students and they have to go into a period of time where they need to study, right? The advice I give is to maybe disengage from social media during this time. However, I would never tell someone to not engage in social media at all, because there are ways in which this provides support and community for many people who aren't able to find that in person or in like a small town. So be mindful of, right, it's not all bad, it's not all evil, but understanding what is the benefit I'm getting from this? What do I hope to achieve here? And being more intentional about your use of these things. I think
what I appreciate about that is that there is this nuance of, it's not making us dumber in the sense of it's not actually like rotting our brains. However, that doesn't mean that it isn't also harming us with the spread of misinformation and an inability to tell what is good and bad information. There's room for both sides of that conversation there of like, no, it's not actually folding our proteins or whatever. It's not getting in there and causing that kind of decline. However, it doesn't mean that it is a wholly moral good. Like, there are still things that we need to discuss about it.
It's not going to be the thing that saves us all, and it's not going to be the thing that dooms us, right? It is generally, I'm in the education space, so I'm good and sick and tired of talking about AI, but I don't have the ability to ignore it anymore. And so that's something that gets brought up in educational spaces a lot. And so like a very big conversation that's happening right now in education spaces is with AI tools and the ability to have the AI write your homework. What does that mean in terms of like beneficial strategies for learning, right? So a lot of times, like the point of writing a paper for a class is not just to assess your knowledge, it's to develop the skill of writing a paper, right?
And so I thought it was to prove that you have access to ChatGPT.
Right? So like, what does that mean? And are there ways in which, like, are there good ways to interact with this tool? Because on the other hand, this could break down a lot of barriers for people. For a large portion of my career, I was an academic advisor for psychology students and helping them to apply to graduate school. And they'd have to like write emails to professors to like ask if they could be in their graduate program. And I was like, I'm going to give you a template because you're going to spend hours and hours and hours like I did stressing out about what is essentially academic dating, where you're like, hey, I think you're really cool. And like, I'm really cool. And like, maybe if you have funding, maybe we could like work together. And it's super weird and awkward. So I'd be like, so to save you time, here is generally a template to use, right? And that's something that somebody has access to because they have the privilege of working, you know, in a certain environment, certain people. And so, right, in what ways is ChatGPT similar to, hey, here's, you don't have to guess about this. People have done this before. Here's a template. And in which ways is this like, you don't have to think anymore or develop a skill anymore. let me just do that for you, right? Like there is nuance and distinction there. And it's not going to go away, and it's very annoying. But I think it's useful for students and for teachers to think about, like, what is it that I want them to get out of this assignment? Like, what is the end goal, and how are we making active steps towards achieving that goal instead of, like, I don't know, just like a box to check in terms of, like, all right, turn in the paper. Like, okay, I mean, you are, at least in higher education, paying for this, so... what is that?
You know, I was also curious to see that your upcoming book discusses photographic memory.
Yes.
You know, people with photographic memories, eidetic memories, are sometimes treated as having a superpower. I very specifically remember eidetic memory being a superpower in the TV show Heroes. Do you ever remember Heroes?
Yes.
That spectacular first season, and then it just disappeared. And we don't like to talk about the future seasons. But one of the characters on the show, her power was just eidetic memory, which is a real thing that some people have. So is it actually a superpower? Is it more, are we making more of it than it is? What is all of that? And why did those memories exist and others don't? Why are some people so special? Why are some people God's favorite?
The answer I give students is you probably don't have photographic memory, so we don't need to talk about it, but it is fascinating. It is interesting. Usually people will, I'll talk about memory and then someone will say, but what about photographic memory? Is it like, aha, gotcha. And I'm always like, but you don't, right? This is so, photographic memory or eidetic memory is actually incredibly rare. It exists. It happens. It is incredibly rare. There is often an overlap with savantism. Not all the time, but there is a high overlap of savantism and Asperger's with eidetic memory. There's been some really interesting studies on that where it's, so savantism is where somebody has a really exceptional skill set that is highly above average while the rest of the cognitive abilities are highly below average, right? And so there's just like big contrast, right? And most of the people who have savantism will, or like a more than, you know, one would suspect, that skill set is in memory for a thing, right? Like their thing is like dates. There are some people who can just like tell me, right, like a date, and I know the you know, day of the week, the month, the weather, right? Like that is the thing. Which is, and that happens more often than other types of things. Usually it's like a high memory is one of these things. So one thing to know, it's usually very specific, right? Like one specific
Mine's
type.
Marvel
of
superheroes. I just listen.
Yeah. Right. You know, Marvel superheroes. There's also some really interesting literature that I find fascinating about like how like kids can have these really specific areas of interest. And like what happens when they like for some reason that tends to decline as we age. And so there seems to be something special about childhood and like having a really specific area of interest. And it saddens me a little that for a lot of people that declines, like your ability
Wait,
to
does
know.
Does it fully decline or does it come back? Because I don't know. So maybe social media is rotting my brain, even though you told me it doesn't. But I always thought it was like this whole thing where like kids will have a super specific special interest. And then we go off in the world and we lose that. And we get told, stop thinking about trains and trains aren't actually that fascinating. And then when we become old men who once again become obsessed with trains and the train kid becomes the train old man. Is that not a thing? Do we not?
I like
not
the idea that, back? That the train old man is just like closing the loop. From
just close it. Just closing that loop.
Right. I was always a train kid and now I'm a train man.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So now we're talking about like developing an area of expertise, which people can have highly specialized areas of knowledge because that's an area that interests them and they engage in all the time. And that is their area of expertise. So like, absolutely. If you are interested in something, if you're interested in Marvel comic superheroes, then that is something that you engage with a lot and write and think about a lot. And you are an expert, right? And so that's not necessarily like a special memory. It's just like, that's an area of expertise that you have, right? It's just that we seem to label it differently when it's a hobby or an interest versus an occupation. But it's the same type of like mechanisms that like, if you were being paid to do that, then no one would think it's weird that you know all these things because it's your job, but it's the exact same thing. So there's expertise, but in your, you know, question about like photographic memory, it's like, it's, there seems to be something, the implication is that it's not this purposeful and directed. It's just happens automatically. Right. And that seems to be the distinction that this is just, people just know these things without having to interact with it constantly in the way that we do when we develop expertise. So it does happen. It is incredibly rare, which also makes it kind of difficult to fully understand. Is it kind of like a superpower? Maybe, but oftentimes in the cases that we do see this coming up, it's again, like so highly specific that it's not super useful to other aspects of your life, right? It is perhaps a useless superpower in that sense.
I was going to say, it seems to be coming down to like, oh no, the plane is going down. Quick, is there anybody that remembers what the weather was like on Tuesday, January 29th in 1932? Hi!
What are you going to do with that? Not much.
Okay, I do want to be very respectful of your time. So I want to ask two real quick questions that I think everybody who listens to a show about memory wants to ask the expert about. Number one, why don't husbands remember where they put things?
That's a great question. You know, there are a variety of factors that could contribute. There was a really interesting study that I read about memory loss after the loss of a spouse. And how many times in a partnership you take on specific jobs and cognitive tasks. And so, and I've been in a relationship with my spouse for almost a decade now. And so I am experiencing this where there are things that I used to do and know about my life and things that he does now, right? I'm like, I don't do cars, you do cars. That's fine. And I do other things, right? And that is some of the trade-off. And so one of the really very real aspects of depression and grief and loss following the loss of a partner is you don't know where things go. That wasn't your job. That was, you offloaded that, right? And this happens in a family context as well, right? Like you have someone in your family who is like the go-to tech person and that's just what they do, right? And I'm very sorry for that person and that family, right? But then you don't have to remember it because that person was doing it. You have this sort of like shared collective memory of things. And that absolutely happens, right? And when you're living with somebody now, maybe there needs to be some renegotiation of like whose actual responsibility and job it is to remember the things, right? And that doesn't mean that you can't like revisit and reevaluate it, but that is a very real thing. It might be because he doesn't have to remember. You always find it.
I also want to ask if you agree with me in my take that the movie 50 First Dates is actually a horror movie. Yes. And not the romantic comedy that people that label it as.
Yes. Yeah. How, I mean, you, again, part of being a partner with somebody is like sharing your life with them. And how are you sharing your life with somebody who you have to like reconvince to marry you every single day? That sounds exhausting. I didn't get married so that I could like live in a perpetual state of like convincing you that I'm worth your time. That sounds awful to me. I agree.
And also, what if she wakes up one day and she's like, no, the VHS tape is not doing it for me. I'm going to need a much better explanation. How do I know this wasn't Photoshop? Like, how do I know this wasn't like edited? Like, we can do crazy things with AI these days.
Yeah, I have a lot of issues with this like idea that this one man will be like it's, and not just like, because like he, it makes him static in time for her too. Like, here's this VHS of all the things. And like, there's, right? Like, you're not also showing me the fights we had. Like, you're not showing me like the disagreement.
Yeah. We've only ever had good days.
It's only ever been wonderful, right? But that also means that like, you've never had to learn from the fights that we've had. You've never had to like grow and change in response to these things. No, it is horrifying. It is absolutely horrifying.
I feel like there's room for like a horror remake in the modern day where somebody does that, but it's like deep faked every day. And it's actually terrible. Like some sort of like Truman Show, 50 First Dates, deep fake AI kind of crossover. It's terrifying implications. I was like, no, that woman is not consent. I don't know that woman is fully consenting. That's not great. It's not great. So you specifically teach people how to learn, how to be great students, how to do all of that. And you do that in a big way on your own show. So I want to use these last few moments with you to let you tell people about what it is that you actually do for a living and where they can find your show and more about you.
So I'm a learning nerd. I went to school for like 9 years to learn how people learn, in part kind of to speak back to what you mentioned earlier, because I think learning, I always thought of learning as like a superpower. Like I remember when my mom was helping learn to read when I was like 6 years old, and she told me that if I learned how to read, I could learn how to do anything, right? I could go from a state of like not knowing something to knowing something. She also like sweetened the pot by telling me that not everyone in every time and place has been allowed to learn, right? And allowed to learn how to read. And so I was like, does everyone know this? Like, does everyone know that you can just like read a book and like learn a thing? Do people know? Like, that's really cool that you can just do this. And so I think of my job as trying to help people go from where they are now and give them the tools and strategies they need to help them get to where they want to be, to change from a state of not knowing something or doing something and being something and becoming that person who now is really highly knowledgeable in this or can do these things. With, you know, with medical students, so I do that in the context of like understanding way more about your learning and probably usually telling them that like sleep is their friend and they should be doing more of that. With a learning scientist, we break down some of the effective strategies based on years and decades, and in some cases, a full over century of evidence on here on the effective practices, things that we know will work for almost anyone in almost any situation, and kind of talk about the nuances of that. We have a regular blog that we post every week, just about. Occasionally we do a podcast instead, where we will break down a concept or review a new piece of literature. One of the things that kind of frustrates me about this knowledge and why I love your podcast and others like it, right? The ability to interview experts to share this information. Because at some point in my career, I said, you know, this is all really great and cool. And like, I want to help other people have this superpower. If I only talk to other experts on this and publish papers on it, nobody outside will know, not the teachers who like don't have the time or, you know, resources to read up on cognitive. Why would you be like, if you are a sixth grade teacher, why on earth would you be signing up to read the journals that like a cognitive psychologist publishes in? You are trying to buy pencils for your students, right? Like you are not like going to conferences that are talking about these things. So we all as a group felt really strongly that we wanted to be able to talk about the research and science behind learning and to work with people who were like doing the teaching and doing the learning. And so that's been a really amazing and really rewarding avenue to do those things in. So we have our blog, our podcast. We also have a book. I have a book with that group, Ace That Test, A Student's Guide to Learning Better. We're really proud of the four of us in the group, Drs. Megan Sumeraki, Cynthia Niebel, Carolina Cooper-Tetzel, and myself work together to make that book along with our really fabulous illustrator, Karina Tiller. And it's really great. We love it. And it's a book for we had high school students in mind who were going to university, right? So what can I do to be successful in college? Well, we'll talk about learning strategies and what that looks like, because there really isn't that much advice we saw for people in that demographic. That there's a lot of, if you Google like how to learn, whatever, there are a lot of people, really successful people, telling you how they did it, which is not super useful for you unless you are already a successful person who has the time, energy, and resources to do the things that they do. And there usually wasn't a lot of like science or evidence behind it. It would just be like, I'm great and you should do things because I'm great, which I, you know, don't like. So we believe really strongly in providing evidence-based practices and explaining them in ways that are accessible to anyone who wants to learn them.
Well, Dr. Althea Need-Kaminsky, this has been a pleasure that I hope I remember for a long time. If not, there will always be this podcast to go back and listen to. So thank you so much for being here. It has been a treat and a dream.
Awesome. Thank you.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Dr. Althea Need-Kaminsky. Remember, her new book, The Psychology of Memory, is available now. Now, if you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. The first and freest way is to just tell your friends, you know, just like take the headphone out of your ear, turn to the person next to you and just say, hey, I just listened to this really cool podcast. And you know what? I want to remember, see, haha, I'm tying it into the content of the show. I want to remember it. So I'm going to like see one, do one, teach one. And I'm just going to like tell you about this really cool podcast. And then see, now you're both listening to this really cool podcast and you'll both remember it. And maybe you'll make a new friend or an enemy on the bus forever. Maybe don't do this. Maybe that's a terrible idea. Or see, if that's a bad idea, or if you're not in a position to do that, you could just take the little app that's on your phone right now and just go ahead and rate the show 5 stars. Just rate the show 5 stars. Maybe leave a little comment, just talking about your favorite part of this episode or any of your other favorite most recent episodes. You could do that, a little 5-star, little comment that helps bump the show up in the algorithm and tells the math problem that runs everything to recommend the show to other listeners like you. Now, if you want to give a little bit of money here or there to make sure that the lights stay on here at Head on Fire Enterprises, you can do so on Patreon, patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you want to give as little as $1 a month, you totally can. You can give any amount of money. All of the rewards are available for everyone at any level, because I don't want to gatekeep. So you get additional audio and video content, early access to episodes, input on future guests, all sorts of stuff. So it's really cool. It's really great. Plus, I have some upcoming projects that those folks on Patreon are going to be the first to know about. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I am at Head on Fire Pod everywhere. I, in retrospect, probably should have made that something that sounded or looked like my name in any kind of measurable way, but I did not. And I guess I'm stuck with that now. So TikTok, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Still on Twitter, still very much deciding whether or not I want to keep that. But pretty much any social media that you have, if you want to find me at Head on Fire Pod, that's the way to do it. Also, I keep forgetting to tell you all, but I do have an email address. You can email me rather than trying to slide into my DMs. Emails are a whole lot easier to see. That email address is contact@headonfirepod.com. Anyways, I'm going to go because, you know, I can't stay behind this microphone forever. So I'm going to go. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks so much for downloading and streaming and telling all your friends and all of the support. It means the world. I'm going to go, but I'm going to remind you to never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.